Everybody loves a lover. I'm a lover. Everybody loves me. Anyhow, that's how I feel. Wow, I feel just like a Pollyanna.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to yet another unforgettable installment of your favorite podcast, In Bed with Nick and Megan, featuring the kingly Nick Offerman.
Good evening.
And his helpmate, Megan Mullally.
Woo!
And today, very, very specially featuring Margaret Cho. How did we ever book her? Oh my gosh. Hi, Margaret. This is so exciting.
I'm so excited.
I just feel like we want to woo you into being friends with us, and we're trying to figure out how to put our best foot forward.
I would love it. I think okay, I used to see you at that Mexican restaurant on Ventura.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember?
Yeah, you mean like after you know, tapings, that kind of thing?
Yes, probably Mexicali, or even, was it the one, it's like near Laurel Canyon. Is that Mexicali?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is. This is the one I know because I would. That's the only time I would be over there is when I would go with Megan after Will and Grace tapings.
Right.
For margaritas.
Oh, yeah.
Yummy.
I love that. Well, we didn't get to spend the kind of quality time that I would have liked to have then. So let's try to make up for that now.
We'll make up for lost time.
Yeah, let's do it. So I want to mention that you are a not very well-known international art thief. We've established that already in our pre-podcast musings because we're on Zoom with you right now and we can see this kind of fabulous piece of art behind you on the wall. And you said that it was procured under suspicious circumstances.
In Kathmandu, during a general strike, when they have the general strikes, you can't do anything. And I was determined to buy this Tonka because I just come from Tibet and I thought I have to have all of this, these Tonkas around a Tonka, T-H-A-N-K-A.
Okay, explain what that is for those of us like me who don't know what it is.
They're I think different, the religious paintings, they're all of the Buddha in all the different forms.
Oh, I didn't know that's what they were called. Okay, beautiful.
They're kind of, they're all sort of the same. I actually, when I was in Tibet, I went to a Tonka school where they would show you how to do it. And it, in a way, it's a little bit all paint by numbers because they're all the same. they want to have a uniform quality to all of them. But I wanted to have one. And so I bought it against the law when I was in Kathmandu.
Uh-huh.
Nice.
It also,
I like a rebel.
It reminds me of, am I wrong in thinking that it's reminiscent of your tattoos?
Yes.
They seem like they're of a piece.
I have a lot of tattoos, but those, I don't have any Tonkas of tattoos. I think there are, people do get tattoos of them. I don't have any Buddhas, but I do have lotus-like blossoms and peonies and things like that. So yes,
nice.
they are reminiscent of tattoo art. I had a long time ago, I had my colors done because I thought I'm not going to wear makeup. I'm just going to have everything in my house flatter my skin. So I did all of the walls and decor in colors that would flatter my skin. But of course, I still have to make makeup on top of that because I can't stop gilding the lily.
Well, you look terrific.
Thank you.
Really do. I don't have any tattoos, but I was thinking like starting when I turn like 70-ish, I might just start, just do my entire body.
I think so. I think it's like, you know, everybody should experience it maybe, you know, at any point. I think it's hard if you're an actor because then you want to be able to transform into anything, and having a tattoo really roots you in the reality of one kind of person. So mm-hmm. In a sense, it's hard for actors to get them.
It is. I have only two tattoos, one on each bicep of my arms, because I'm a swaggering macho sailor. I don't know if you know this about me, but I was like age 20 and 21 when I got my tattoos. And one of my theater professors just about took me out to the woodshed. He was so upset with me, yelling at me, simply saying, and he's my kabuki teacher. So he's my sensei. He's this beautiful Zen artist. And so it wasn't just, you know, that's terribly impractical, you idiot. He was saying, you're an actor, your body is your canvas. And now every time you start a painting, you already have graffiti on your wall. And I said, you shut up.
Punched him in the face.
Yeah.
Yes, it's true. And they're very hard to cover up when you actually have to. So I would say, you know, I think if you're an actor, it's probably not the best decision. But I grew up around people who were very tattooed and were getting full body suit tattoos in the 70s and the 80s. So I'm a very early adopter to that kind of stuff. So I do love tattooing. And I think, you know, I just wear more clothes in general if I'm acting.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Because now you have to get the permission of the tattoo artist. That's like a whole other level has been added to it.
Right. The only ones that are controversial is that I have ones on my butt cheeks that are, it's like two women facing each other. And that artist is very, I don't know, he's strict about the way that he wants his tattoos put out in the media. I mean, not that my butt would be out at any time. I mean, it's not out much.
It's out right now, though, dear listener. I feel you need to visualize what's happening right now.
Those ladies are really looking at each other.
Yeah. Well, their noses kind of go like around my butthole. But both looking at my butthole. And like, why would you be that protective of that image? I mean, it's like it's dumb. But it, you know, they're very protective of their work.
That's so funny. Well, we asked you to pick a topic for today, and you picked probably one of the most interesting topics we've had, if not the most interesting, self-care and self-comfort.
Yes. Yes.
Also known as self-care and masturbation.
What?
Yes.
Or is my misreading?
You got it backwards.
Masturbation is very important, especially now, especially in this day of kind of being with oneself all the time.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, it's a way of self-soothing and a way of self-regulating.
And diminishing your anxiety.
Yeah, it's very helpful. Mm-hmm. And also, we have time. Anything, that's what we have a lot of.
Yeah, you got like an extra spare 10 minutes. Yeah.
But we can take more time now with that. You could have quite a romance with yourself if you want to. You could have a bath before or
nice.
After or whatever is your fancy.
Yeah. Cute.
But yeah, I think it's meaningful. I think that these are the things that we have. But self-soothing in general, whatever form that takes.
So like, what else are you thinking?
I have been playing.
What do you do?
The melodica, which is a.
Really?
It's kind of like a harmonica, but it's not. It's like a tube, and it's kind of a jokey instrument because it's sort of like people sort of associate it with like the accordion. But the accordion is actually really beautiful. They're very hard to play because it's combination bellows and piano. And the melodica, again, also is the same thing. It's like a bellows and a piano. So I'm trying to work my way around it.
Oh, my gosh. Where do you get a melodica?
A melodica? Oh, I just bought it on reverb.com, which is my favorite. Website.
That's a great website.
Wait, is this a newish acquisition or something you've been working on for a while?
No, I just got the melodica a couple of days ago because I thought this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to learn how to play the melodica, and I'm not good, but I still have one now. It was $40.
You know what? There's been a lot of chatter, obviously, about what to do during all this, you know, time we're suddenly find ourselves with, and it hadn't occurred to me, but it's a brilliant idea. it's ideal right now to learn a musical instrument mm-hmm. because
or learn a language.
You can't be around the people, you know, if you can get to where people can't hear you,
yes,
then you can get through the really awkward phase where it sounds untenable.
Right. Which is, I mean, most of the music that I make, it you don't, nobody wants to hear it. And I think that's good, you know, because I want to hear it. Like, I enjoy just making sounds, and I live alone, fortunately, so I can make all of the sound that I like. And my house is sort of set apart from other houses, so I can really be loud. Probably ooh, not good. The best, because if I get murdered here, you couldn't hear that either. But, you know, I'm willing to take that.
We promise not to murder you, if that helps. That's two people you don't have to worry about.
I'm so glad. I feel safe. But yeah, making music helps. Anything creative helps. But, you know, like, I think people have this need right now to think that we have to be productive. And that's sort of a, I don't care to be productive. I don't care. No. I just want to, like, be comfortable.
Yeah, me too. I don't feel any pressure to, you know, come out of this at the end of it with 7 new talents and a, you know, the great American novel. I really am just every day I'm like, okay, well, what do I really feel like doing right now? And I think that that's a great luxury for all of us. And there's something really important about that and elemental, and it's got to be healthy, very healthy in a lot of ways. I mean, unless, you know, what you're doing is making you more anxious. Like if you're watching the news 24/7, that's probably not good, but.
No, it's scary to watch the news. I mean, we're already in a lot of fear anyway. And I myself am such a germaphobe. Like, I'm really afraid of any illness whatsoever.
Yeah.
So this is like, it's nightmare upon nightmare. And I had just worked right before we went into this lockdown situation, I'd worked with Howie Mandel. And so he and I
was... He was the original germaphobe, yeah.
Yeah, just being upset about who was going to get sick and how this was going to make us sick. And he was upset because he had not had not the opportunity to create a lot of antibodies in a system, because he's never allowed himself to be sick, or he doesn't like any of that. So he was extra worried, and then I was extra worried on top of it, and it was like we were trying to get on top of the fear. And so fear doesn't help.
No, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got our phones all day long with bulletins popping up, but we've limited our actual, you know, television news intake to about half an hour to an hour a night. Just to get, you know, just so we know what's happening and the facts and figures. And
yeah, I mean, I think that's a healthy thing. But bad news seeps in. Well, like today, I think probably my favorite modern songwriter, Adam Schlesinger, has passed away from this disease, from COVID. And that's such an awful thing. Like, what a huge loss. I mean, I'm really just very upset about that. So, you know, it's just being pummeled with bad news constantly. It's difficult.
Yeah, we were watching MSNBC last night, and we really hadn't put in our full, you know, quota yet. And I just said, we gotta start watching some reality television, because I'm about to burst into tears.
Yeah,
it was just way, way too much. Just the numbers, you know, it's really, I don't, there's not even a word. I don't even, you know, you can't even put a, it's hard to describe, but we're all in it together, you know.
That is the one thing that I think is that it is a very uniting kind of experience. I think that in itself is something that's comforting. Although I'm also worried about the violence towards Asian Americans because of all of this, you know, part of this is really, kind of made people want to blame somebody. And
well, when you call it the Chinese virus, I mean, it's just, it defies comprehension.
Yeah. So that's a scary kind of a thought too. It's like, oh, having to deal with racism on top of that, that it is a very, you know, it's kind of, I don't know. There's lots of different things that make it very scary.
Well, yeah, I agree. And there's so much stupidity around that too. I mean, very early on, everybody stopped going to Chinese restaurants as if that somehow had anything to do with it, you know?
Yeah, it's a really scary thing. But I mean, that's why I think self-comforting and self-care comes in handy, because you're dealing with a lot of this, like, suffering all over on a lot of different levels. So a sheet mask really gets down to the heart of the problem. I mean, a sheet mask. I'll do a hands and feet mask. I will get in there, because I can't go to that. You can't go to the salon to get. That's the thing, is that my gel is hanging on for like a month.
Oh, I know. Everybody's freaking out over their gels. Yeah. But what about your roots? Do you have hair dye?
Well, I do my own roots. This is very Asian, with squid ink.
Ooh.
It's a squid ink hair color. So I'm pretty.
That is the dopest fact. I've never heard that.
There's Korean hair dye that you can do by yourself that's made of squid ink. And I had bought a whole bunch of it in Koreatown a couple of months ago. And I'm glad I have that. So now I can go back and do, but I can't get the back. So, but it's fine if I get the front. That's all I need.
Yeah, that's all I need. I know. Yeah, all of that stuff. One of the first things that I ordered online when the shit started to go down was just a shitload of skincare products. Because I was like, well, my skin's gonna look fucking amazing at the end of this.
Well, your skin always looks great. Now, what is your regimen? What do you use? Are you?
I don't know. I got a whole bunch of different kinds. I like the all natural ones. Like Naturopathica is a good one, and there's a line called Osea.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I love them. Yeah.
Are those really good? Yeah.
They're like original clean beauty people. That they're very, very good.
Yeah. So we're on the same wavelength in that regard.
I'm using a lot of heavy retinols.
Oh yeah, I've been doing that too.
I'm going hard with the retinols. Do you do skincare too?
I don't usually do that.
What is a retinol, may I ask?
It's acid.
It's from retin A. It kind of, you know, it's like a peel.
I'm just kidding. Of course I know what those are. I love skincare products. I love lava soap. It has
pumice.
Mm-hmm. It's very abrasive. There's not a wood glue that's been made that can stand up to lava soap.
Oh gosh, he's not really kidding though.
Lava soap is it's actually a good thing to have. Like I always confuse that with Irish Spring, because I want to cut it. I want to like whittle it down, like in an Irish Spring commercial.
What were some of your favorite TV shows growing up? Were you really into TV? I was.
I was. I loved Good Times, because there was a feeling of anarchy in the audience.
And best theme song ever.
They're the best theme song. I always loved JJ's artwork. I liked the family.
Yeah.
And I liked that in the audience, you could have a whole bunch of different reactions. Like sometimes people would gasp. You know, when in fear, that there was a lot of different things happening. So I like that kind of, I like when there's disorder in the audience. You would hear that sometimes a little bit in like Ab Fab, like the early seasons of Ab Fab, when they were showing it on Comedy Central here in America, you would see that there was a little bit of that kind of like lawlessness in the audience, and people really getting excited. So I like that. I liked really old Saturday Night Live, when they used to have comedians on like Andy Kaufman or Joan Rivers or George Carlin would do sets. Steve mm-hmm. Martin, of course, classically do sets. And then there was a lot of reruns. So I always liked the shows like the Patty Duke show.
Yeah.
Who was always really great. And I ended up becoming friends with her a little bit later in life. And she was always a good one for a Hollywood talk. She was going to go to Sharon Tate's house because she had an argument with Sharon Tate because I think that she had something to do with the rental of the property. And then she was going to go over there the night that they were all murdered, but she didn't want to because she had a cold and didn't want to pass it on to Sharon Tate. So she ended up not showing up. And I thought that was a really an amazing thing that night she would have been there. So
that's crazy.
Wow.
Patty Duke was always somebody that I always thought, wow, she's somebody that like, I'm so grateful that I got to know. And, but somebody that I idolized, which she was identical cousins on her television show.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's amazing that they could do that show back then with, you know, without the technology.
Yes,
that we have now, and
I
pull
never
it
saw
off.
That show did she played cousins on the Patty Duke show?
Because they're cousins, identical cousins, and you're fine. Yeah,
but you would just see like the shoulder of one, and then the scene happened, and then I don't know how it was always like shoulder perspective of the other cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
Pretty good. I bought it. I thought, yeah, she's two people. I thought it seemed very, very convincing. And what about movies? Like what?
Well, of course, like Star Wars was a very, a very big thing. I remember the first time seeing Star Wars, I had a boyfriend. I must have been like 7 years old. And I had
because you're about 10 years younger than me and I was 18. So.
Okay.
But like,
yeah, I'm surprised that I had a boyfriend, but he and I went to the movies. We went to the premiere, I guess, not the premiere, but the San Francisco opening of Star Wars. And we went with his parents, and his parents in line on the way in going into the theater smoked a joint. And it was so shocking.
Where were you? Where were you?
We were in San Francisco going to the Coronet Theater, which is on Gary.
Oh. Yeah.
And so we were in line and his parents smoked a joint and he was unfazed, but I was in shock. And because I kind of knew what it was, even though I probably shouldn't have known.
Mm-hmm.
Now here you are.
I was in Los Angeles that summer when I was 18 and I went to, one of those theaters in Westwood. It was that one that's like on Wilshire Boulevard. It's like a big freestanding one. And we went and waited. It was the very first time that I think it was the first time that there were lines around the block for a movie. And it was the opening weekend. And we waited and waited and just all these other, you know, basically young people out there just, yeah, it was pretty cool. And then when the movie started, do you remember just being like so freaked out? Because nobody had ever seen anything like that. When they hit warp speed, like the whole theater started screaming.
Yes. Yes. Because we would all just brace ourselves. I mean, even just the beginning with the scroll of the galaxy far, far away, you know, just having all of this stuff. I mean, there were so many things about it that were so innovative that we'd never seen. Yeah. And and also parents smoking joints, also never seen.
Yeah, I feel like I'm clearly a cis, straight, white guy, grew up in small town Illinois.
It's okay, honey.
And I'm, I'm recovering. But growing up, my grandfather took my older sister to San Francisco one time for a trip. And she came back with like somebody had done a caricature drawing of my grandfather on a streetcar. And so as I grew up and learned and, you know, began to consume culture and music and film and books, San Francisco was always this like magical, like of all the American cities, that was where, that was by far the grooviest land of Oz.
Ooh, yeah.
And so you were kind of, we're about the same age, like growing up.
Well, you
there,
would have been Lori would have been the exact same age.
Yeah, my sister would have been your same age. And so I wish we could have been pen pals, because it took me almost to like age 30 to where I'd been a few times to California, but like, I had a really hard time like wrapping my head around the reality of San Francisco and Los Angeles, also to an extent of how you are, well, like everything is permitted, you know, these cities, I guess in a way it's what has been come to call, be called sanctuary cities. But I consider that kind of for everybody. Like there's a general sense, and of course there's assholes any place, but there's a general sense in these cities, whoever you are, you can find love and respect, and whatever you want to try, you can try it here.
And it's creative.
Yeah, that's creative. And I mean, but there's also like stuff that I remember, the negativity of things like that, that because things were so open and people would sort of kind of be fearless about stuff, you would run into situations. Like I remember 1978 being a very big deal, because that was the year that Harvey Milk and George Moscone were assassinated. And then a few weeks later, the Jonestown massacre happened, because Jonestown with the People's Temple, which is the church that was the Jonestown crew came from, was from San Francisco. And it was right in the neighborhood that I grew up in. So thing of like, you know, I think because of the People's Temple was really a part of San Francisco, in that there was a church that was trying to welcome all races and be inclusive and be a different kind of form of religion. I mean, I can see like now you look back in history and think of it as a very negative, terrible thing, which it is. But the initial thing was the spirit of everything being permissible and for this new kind of church to occur. So there were so many bad things that I think about it when I think about San Francisco back then, and the permissive nature of it, and hippies and all of that. I mean, it all can go bad. In LA, of course, you had Charlie Manson. And so there's a different layer, that there's a sinister element to living in California.
It's the yin and the yang, right? Because, you know, like I grew up in Oklahoma City and everything was just kind of like this, you know, there's like, something would be kind of good and then something would be kind of bad, but not really that good and not really that bad. Everything was kind of in the middle somewhere, and probably same with Nick. But then when you live in some of these bigger metropolitan areas where there are so many great pluses that you don't have elsewhere, then you also get the minuses to balance.
But then I think Oklahoma City now, just this week, is very famous for being where the Tiger King is from.
Yeah, he's from, yeah. I know, he's from a town outside of Oklahoma City, but I have to say, as completely preppy as the neighborhood is where I grew up and suburban and all of that, and that guy, Joe Exotic, as completely orthodox as he reminds me of, like, I'm like, oh yeah, that guy's from Oklahoma.
Oh yeah, you recognize it. You can see.
Yeah,
it.
I recognize him for sure. Don't you?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's weird. Like there are people there who have that eccentricity, even if it's in the context of, you know, their eccentricity is just drinking a lot of booze and cheating on their wives. They have these big personalities. It's really interesting.
I like the eye ring. It's like, that's the one thing that I couldn't stop watching during that whole series, is that
the eye
like
yes.
ring that when he talked, it would shake.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's going to fall out.
And there was a photo of him from when he was really young and he had it. So he'd had it forever.
But it was like, what is it attached to? Because it's like, people don't get that eye skin pierced that often. I mean, I guess it may have been an eyebrow ring and it may have grown out, or he'd plucked his eyebrows around it. I'm not sure.
I don't know, but I just got a little thing on my phone today that he is in coronavirus isolation in prison right now. His boyfriend has announced just as of today, Joe Exotic.
Oh, man. His boyfriend or his husband, Daryl Passage?
Husband. His husband, Daryl Passage, excuse me.
And I think he now goes by Joe Maldonado Passage.
That's right.
If memory serves.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, man. We had to keep, he had that very European real last name, which he then turned into Joe Exotic. And then as we went through the series, for the different like real estate scams, he kept taking the names of these hapless, lovely young men that he kept wedding.
Yeah. I like their the group wedding with the three of them. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really touching. I mean, I've never even thought about a triad like that before, but
yeah, it was groovy.
Okay, so let me clear up the story here. So he was transferred from another jail where there were some cases. So he doesn't have it as of right now, but they've put him in COVID-19 quarantine.
Because he came from a jail where it existed.
There were cases at the other jail.
So he's not presenting, but because we have no tests, there's no telling.
And he told this to, of course, none other than Andy Cohen on his Sirius XM.
Yeah, Andy's going to get all over
Immortal
that scoop.
Radio show. Yeah, so let's get back to our self-care and self-pampering. And so let's see. So I'm kind of always on the self, you know, care
you take
train.
Insane care of yourself. I mean, you were born beautiful.
Oh,
but
gosh.
Megan, more than anybody I've ever met, because she obviously is also very talented. I've never seen anybody like, in my mind, growing up, when I would like laugh at somebody in a movie, for some reason, Chris Rock always springs to mind. I always thought, man, it'd be so great to be that funny because you could just go to work and you probably smoke a joint in your trailer and they're like, hey, Chris, we're ready for you to come do your scene. And you come out and you're like, hey, I'm Chris Rock. Here's my fucking hilarious scene. And they're like, you're amazing. Here's a bag of weed. Go take a break. And then I work hard and I follow my path and I get to where I get to like be in TV and movie scenes. And you realize the last thing you can do is, you know, be intoxicated in any way. Like you want to be, I mean, generally there are people who like to take the edge off, but it's not intoxication. It's people defeating like stress to a certain extent. So I've worked with people who like had to get high, but it's because they were too scared to go on stage without it.
Right. They like use it almost like a beta blocker.
Right. Mm. And it's like people who wake and bake. They don't use it for enjoyment. They use it to try and find a level of equilibrium.
Right. It's to regulate. It's like to self-regulate. And I think that's a viable use for that.
Absolutely. Sure. I mean, my best friend smokes a ton of weed and it's a thing. Like, you know, he's in his 50s and it's a thing where it's like, if it was me, that would be a terrible, I would have to go to like, I'd have to go to AA and like get off it. But for him, it's a self-regulation, a mm-hmm. form of self-care. But I jumped us off the rails of, what I was saying is, Megan, I've never seen anybody with, she is the Chris Rock of this household. And nonetheless,
thanks, honey.
Whatever she's working on, she works so hard, whether she's singing a song at a benefit or doing a movie or doing a TV show, she is doing her homework. She like goes into a room and shuts the door and like works it and works it and works it and makes it as good as possible. And in the same way, she's so disciplined. As long as I've known her, in just taking care of her skin, she washes herself more. I mean, I take a bath every Sunday. I'm not a hog. But it's...
We have a barrel out in the backyard.
That's very turn of the century. Like, you know, where all the family gets like one hot bath and then they all go and like, according to age.
Yeah.
He lets me go first.
That's nice.
But yeah, that's... I've always admired Megan's discipline because I... You know, I try to keep myself presentable, but...
Well, you know, yeah, I'm not fastidious about my appearance, though. There's just sort of two different things. So, yeah, I take good care of my skin, but I never get manicures and pedicures. Part of it is just because I'm lazy. I do get my hair colored. So those are the two main things. But then I guess the stuff that I do that's probably more important is I try to eat healthy and I don't drink and I don't do drugs and, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And that's really important. I mean, but appearance counts for so much when you're a woman in Hollywood that there's so much of that. Like our work really is maintaining the appearance of whatever that is. I mean, it's really across the board for women in entertainment is that we have to take care of our bodies and our skin and everything. Because it's part of the work. It's not fair, but it just happens to be. And then, you know, part of that, too, is like, well, it's the one part of, I guess, work that is kind of gratifying. And it is, you know, again, like self-care, it's like it sustains itself, you know, especially if we're like on the road and doing shows like on stage and traveling all the time, or you're doing a shoot and you're going in for early call times. You just want to make sure that your skin is okay and you're wearing a lot of makeup for the lights and cameras and whatever. So you just want to make sure that, and HD ruined it for so many of us.
Oh, yeah.
So HD really fucked us up. So now I have to be very diligent.
Yeah. It arrived just in time for our wrinkles and jowls.
Yeah. Thanks. Don't you feel like it's starting to change a little bit though? Because with each passing, you know, season of television primarily, I see more and more actresses. I'm not going to talk about the guys because they can look anyway and nobody cares. But with the women, I see more and more women who don't conform to that. You know, they don't seem to be trying at all, or that nobody seems to care if they're trying or not. Like they don't seem to be expected to have to try. And I think that's a great relief.
It's a great relief, and also different kinds of beauty are appreciated, and and that's really important too.
Yes, because that's life, you know. I mean, there are five people who look like, you know, Jennifer Lopez, and she's one of them, and then everybody else looks like us, you know, or just... relatively attractive.
You're two very beautiful ladies.
Well, like it's attractive in our own way, but not, you know, not Jennifer Lopez.
I'm just not going to work as hard as Jennifer Lopez. Like, I don't care to do all that I know that she does, because that's part of her persona, too, is that she's so driven to hang on to this body.
Yeah. Oh, it's the time... Yeah, the time that goes into it. I mean, to have to work out, you know, for 2 or 3 hours a day, every day, and all of those things. I mean, it's a lot. It's a whole other career, basically. It's so time consuming. And also, I don't know, I would just like to think that it's better to just let it turn out the way that it's supposed to, that was going to turn out without...
I think it's more fun just to not have to worry that much about it, you know? And, you know, and I think she's great. She does her, which is great. I couldn't have the energy. I wouldn't have the stamina for all of it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, yes, exactly. To each their own. I'm glad that Jennifer Lopez does it because I think she's beautiful. I like looking at her, but
and she's inspiring. I mean,
she is.
But you said it well. She does her, and it's and there is an element of heroism, like, you know, it's sort of a hybrid between an artist and an athlete, whereas I think it seems like I could say of the three of us, we're more interested in interesting and provocative thought and notions.
Well, and not that she's not, you know,
right.
But I now I feel bad that I used her as an example, but I think, you know, I'm just trying to make a point.
Yeah, totally.
Cause I've, you know, she did three episodes of Will and Grace over the years. And so I've seen her around at a couple of things, and I think she's just naturally like that. Some people are just like that.
Yeah. But I think she is definitely inspiring. That there's a thing of like, you know, when we as women go into our 50s, that there's something that, like, you know, we have to leave behind the ingenue, but we don't have to. We can just keep on incorporating the ingenue as another aspect of who we are, as J-Lo has, you know? So that, I think that in that, she's a great role model for women in their 50s. Like, it doesn't have to be over. It can just be beginning, which is great.
Yeah, she seems like she's come, you know, she's getting very powerful now. And she kind of always was, but in a different way. And I feel that too. I think, you know, as I get older, I feel better about myself and better about, you know, speaking my mind and standing up for myself, those kinds of things. And I think you've always been really good about that, though. See, I didn't really have that innately, but you seem like you're pretty strong in that way.
Well, I think we have to be in comedy, especially because, like, the way that there aren't that many female comedians, and that you know, we have to sort of make our presence known and be more forceful about our rights and our needs or whatever. So I think it's kind of an aspect of that. I don't think I'm naturally inclined to be really that forceful of a person, but I think because of stand-up comedy, like, I have to be, just because I can't survive without it. That might be it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what was the first thing that, because I would, you know, when I was younger, I would have been petrified to, you know, try being a stand-up or even to do improv comedy or anything like that. But what was the first thing that made you think, you know, I'm going to give that a shot?
Well, I was so young, and I was doing comedy shows like at 14 and 15. And I wasn't alone. I had a comedy partner at first. It was Sam Rockwell, who's, of course, a very famous actor.
Yeah, that's crazy. I didn't know that. That's
amazing.
He was
in my school, and our teacher would sign us up for these open mic nights, which I look back now and I think that's actually really inappropriate. But I'm glad that she did, because it got us out of this thing of like, oh, let's be doing this at night. And we were going to this comedy club and doing shows, and people like Paula Poundstone would be doing shows, like, you know, the same club, or Dana Carvey, Robin Williams sometimes. And, you know, wow. So there was this presence of like really great people. And then it just shoved me into this community that I really wanted to belong to, even though I was a really little kid. So I kind of didn't even know what I was doing until I was already in it. So that's probably good. I was just not old enough to be scared.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, that's so cool.
Well, so that's astonishing. And speaking of self-care, I'm a theater actor. I started in Chicago theater, as did Megan. She's from Oklahoma City, but she went to Northwestern. So she started doing Chicago musicals and plays. And
I did stuff as a kid in Oklahoma City, actually.
So, but we both came into the business
with Joe Exotic,
you know, via the doing straight plays, working in the theater versus the path of stand up or sketch and improv comedy that a lot of our friends followed. And so only in recent years, I started touring as a comedian, and I do shows now, and I really love it. I never expected to do that, but what I'm driving towards is I'm curious, speaking of self-care, what is your situation when you do, because I know you've done, you know, big 38 city tours. What's your deal? Like, what is your rider? How do you take care of yourself? I mean, starting with just your scheduling.
Yeah.
Do you do a city every night, or do you give yourself a day between?
No, I usually do every night, and then I'll probably like, it's probably pretty easy because I just do weekends. So I'll do like, I'll go out like on a Thursday and then do a weekend at a comedy club, or I'll do a city and a night for like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then take the rest of the week off. So it's not as intense. Like I don't, some people like get in a bus, do the tour bus thing, and they go from city to city. And that's like more like rock star touring. But for me, I think it's more comfortable just to do, you know, like a weekend at a time. And then I can come back to town, to LA or New York for the week. But it's too hard for me to do every single night, I think. Because you have to like expend a lot of it. You expend a lot of energy when you do these live shows.
Sure.
Especially if you do two. Do you ever do two a night? That's hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's not, you know, I don't do any acrobatics or anything, but you're burning, you're responsible for the entirety of the light that the audience is seeing. Like the wattage depends entirely on you.
And I sweat so much in my face. My face is sweating so, doesn't your face really sweat when you perform?
He's an equal opportunity sweater. I think every square inch is sweaty on this guy.
I lightly schwitz. And what about your rider? How do you comfort yourself with?
Nothing.
I find that really interesting from comic to comic.
I just have, I'll have like sparkling water on there. I used to eat a lot of the Kind bars.
Sure. It's a good bar.
And sometimes cheese, sometimes olives, although lately I haven't been doing that as much. So I have a pretty limited rider. There's not really a lot on there just because I just don't really need that much there. Maybe I used to have wine and stuff like that, but I don't drink alcohol anymore. So that has...
No, I don't either.
That's made it easier, not drinking, because, you know, then it's actually a lot easier to get up early and you have more energy. I have more energy.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you sleep better.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's another misconception destroyed, like... Cause I, when I first started and did my first touring dates, you know, and they said, okay, what do you want on your rider? And I was like, ooh, I've heard about this. I want a slab of ribs and I want, you know, these hedonistic treats. And then I went and did a few shows, and at some point they were settling with me at the end of the night. And they said, you know, this and this, and here's, you know, here's how much we sold, here's how much you get, minus, you know, here's what we spent on your rider. And I was like, well, hold up, what? Because I had no idea that you pay for your own rider. I was like, oh, no, you know, Carnegie Hall, they have the privilege of supplying my hoagie. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as I learned that it falls on you, then I was like, oh, one water, please. That's all I need.
And no, it doesn't. I mean, sometimes people put those weird things on their rider just because they want to make sure that the promoter's reading it. So that's why it was like whatever band, I think it was Van Halen, didn't want the green M&Ms. It's only because they wanted to make sure that they were reading the rider so that they would have all of their equipment that they needed to get the sound that they wanted. So that was they put those details in there just to make sure they would have, you know, everything else they needed.
I love that. Margaret, I'm so glad you could do the podcast.
I'm so glad, too.
I hope you'll accept us as your new friends.
I would love that. That would make me so happy. Good. Yes, please.
Okay, good.
And if anyone tries to extradite you over that painting, we'll help.
We're sorry in
advance. We'll help hide you.
Yeah, we will.
Thank you very much.
We have an underground railroad for international art thieves.
International art thieves.
Who meant well.
Yeah, who meant well.
Not the evil ones, just the nice ones. Well, this has been another installment of In Bed with Nick and Megan. Thank you, Nick Offerman. Thank you, Margaret Cho.
Thank you, honey.
Good night.
Good night.
In Bed with Nick and Megan is an Earwolf production. It's produced by Megan Mullally, Kevin Bartelt, and Michael Landry. Executive produced by Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon. Music by Nancy and Beth, which can be found at www.nancyandbeth.com. If you enjoyed In Bed with Nick and Megan, make sure to rate it and review the show on Apple Podcasts.